the people who do clinical research here is one reflection of that. So in the talk today, I'm going to give an introduction to cardiology, and then I'll talk about a clinical approach to sudden cardiac death, and then a basic science approach to cardiac death. If there are no medical doctors here, then I can say whatever I want about them. So, okay. Oh, is there a pointer? What's this? This is a schematic picture of the heart. So the heart has its own spontaneous pacemaker, which is called the sinoatrial node, and this generates a rhythm which passes through the atria. It passes then through a region called the atrioventricular node down into the ventricles, and it's the contraction of the ventricles in response to that propagating electrical pulse that pumps the blood throughout the body. So the electrical activity of the heart has been made clearer since the early studies by Eindhoven. So the initial way to measure the electrocardiogram was somebody would stick their hands and feet in salt water, and then you would measure the potential differences between the hands, left hand and right hand, or left foot and right hand, using this rather complicated method. So almost everybody, I guess I would say everybody in the audience, maybe with one or two exceptions, has had the electrocardiogram done, so you all know what that is. This is a schematic picture of the electrocardiogram. Here are P waves, QRS complexes, and T waves. So the P wave is associated with the excitation of the atria of the heart. The QRS complex is associated with the excitation of the ventricles of the heart. And the T wave is associated with the relaxation of the ventricles getting ready for the next heartbeat. So as a result of having over 100 years of looking at electrocardiograms, that cardiologists are now capable of doing reasonably sophisticated analyses based on the electrocardiograms itself. By the way, if anything is unclear, people should just feel free to ask a question or interrupt. So this is now an electrocardiogram from a person, not a schematic picture. Here you can see the P waves, QRS complex, and T wave. So this is a normal beat, and then here's this beat, and this is an abnormal beat, often called the ventricular premature complex or premature ventricular complex. This is originating from some place in the ventricles from an abnormal position in the heart. Notice that when you have this beat here, you still get the normal rhythm, and generally, or what often happens is this normal rhythm is going to keep on going, but the interpretation here is that the next beat took place in the atria, but might have been blocked as it was going down to the AV node because of this prior beat that leaves the heart refractory. Now, this is an electrocardiogram of a patient who died while the patient was having her electrocardiogram being measured. It comes from a database that's run by Ari Goldberger, who's a cardiologist in Boston, and this is from the PhysioNet website, which has lots of data sets of different sorts for everybody in the community. They're open data sets for people to look at. So here at 3:42 in the afternoon, the person had a normal rhythm with an occasional abnormal premature ventricular complex. At 4:05, there was a normal beat, an abnormal beat, so there was an alternation of a normal and abnormal beat, and then a little run of three abnormal beats in a row, and then some normal beats, abnormal beats, little bouts of abnormal beats in a row. So these abnormal beats are called non-sustained ventricular tachycardia. Ventricular tachycardia means a rapid heartbeat coming from the ventricles. And non-sustained ventricular tachycardia means it doesn't stick around for a very long time. Okay? So then here at 7:13, there's this rhythm here, which is very similar to what was happening at 4:05. And then there's a slightly longer sequence of non-sustained ventricular tachycardia. And then there was a ventricular tachycardia, which was sustained and which led to the patient's death. So a question is, why did this transition occur at this point in time and it didn't happen over there? And I don't know the answer, and I don't believe anybody knows the answer to that question. Yeah, this was from a Holter tape that the patient was wearing. You're not a medical doctor?
No, just married to a medical doctor.
You're married to a medical... Okay, now I can pick on you. It's close enough. No, right, so this is from Holter tape recordings. It's obviously recordings like this are not so easy to come by. So the questions are, can we predict who has a high risk of sudden cardiac death, and if we could we prevent the sudden cardiac death? So this is really a very important question for medicine at the moment. I can answer the second question first. Could we prevent sudden cardiac death of the sort that was there? And the answer is probably you could. And the way that's done is by a device called an implantable cardiac defibrillator. This is inserted under the skin. It has leads that go into the heart. And if this detects an abnormal rhythm, such as the one I just showed, it's programmed to give a shock to the heart that terminates that abnormal rhythm. And they're quite successful in preventing and terminating those rhythms, not curing what the underlying disease might be, but in terminating. And we know that is because of this guy. So you might say, why is he smiling? It's not because his politics is very successful or his policies are very successful, but he has one of these. Okay? So he has this device because he's had serious heart problems in the past. So these are reasonably safe and they're reasonably effective, but they're also very expensive. And in terms of trying to assess the risk of sudden cardiac death, there are some patients that meet current criteria for being high risk of sudden cardiac death, but it's a small number of patients, and most patients who actually experience sudden cardiac death fall in groups that have a much lower incidence. Yes?
When the sustained tachycardia occurs,
yes,
at that time, if you do give a defibrillating pulse, would it stop it, or do you have to do it before it occurs?
No. It occurs afterwards. It's given afterwards.
I think so. Would it sustain?
Yeah. No. So the way these things work, so if you ever see these things when they're implanted, which I've seen a few times, is that they've put this in this person's heart, and then how do they test to see if it's working? The way they test if what's working is they give the heart a shock to put it in one of these terrible rhythms, and then they wait, it charges up capacitors, it takes about 20 seconds, it delivers a shock. Then if that works, then they don't do it again. If it doesn't work, then it charges up generally to a higher charge, it goes off. And if that works, then that's okay. And if it doesn't work, they put these paddles on, like in the television shows, and they reverse it. So this is what they do whenever they insert one of these. So
you don't need to predict that a sustained tachycardia is coming.
No, absolutely not. But it's a very big problem to say who should be a candidate for getting one of these devices, because they're expensive. And there can also be complications associated with this device. The leads can break. There have been lots of news stories in the last year about that, in fact. I think it's about 20,000, 20 to 50,000 in that range, generally. Okay, so the standard way for analyzing medical procedures and evaluating them are clinical trials. Such trials are essential for physicians who are treating patients. And trials absolutely have led to very improved therapies, but there are also problems with trials. So here is one strategy to try to treat sudden cardiac death. As we just showed, that some there are premature ventricular complexes occur with increased frequency before sudden cardiac death, and I just showed you an example of that. There was a hypothesis that decrease of these complexes would lead to decreased sudden cardiac death. To test the hypothesis, the physicians give people 730 people a drug that reduces the number of these complexes, and 725 patients a placebo, and then you count the number of people that die as a function of time. So this is the results of that experiment. These are the patients that took the drug. This is the patients that took the placebo. This is the percent alive as a function of time. And as you see, the patients who took the drug had about increased rate of sudden cardiac death. There are about 50 to 60 increased deaths in this population. The experiment, the trial was terminated. And since that time, which it goes back to the early 1990s, physicians cannot use drugs to treat arrhythmias because many of the drugs that they would treat arrhythmias also lead to catastrophic events. Okay, that is the hypothesis was disproved. Okay, so people who write grants for the CAHR know that you're going to get your grant rejected if you don't have a clear hypothesis. Somehow or other, that's an essential thing. Okay, so that's not the strategy that we've taken. So what we believe in doing is trying to analyze mechanisms of arrhythmia by confronting theory and experiments, and we're interested in trying to understand one thing at a time rather than everything. So in the talk today, I'm going to talk about a little bit about reentrant rhythms on universal patterns of spatiotemporal dynamics and a particular rhythm called parasystole, and then try to say a little bit at the very end about how we try to put all of these together to try to think about ways to understand mechanisms of arrhythmias. So the rationale to study model systems, real arrhythmias are very hard to understand. So people don't really know what's happening in the heart during that initial electrocardiogram of the patient who died. The model systems do present fascinating theoretical problems. They show universal properties, and they're amenable to careful experiments in the laboratory, but the big problem is the links to humans may be tenuous and not easily demonstrated or funded. That's a sore point these days, because our most recent CIHR grant was rejected. Anyway, so this is a model system that we've used a lot, and this was work that goes back. I'm just going to show one slide from the first study. It goes back to the early 1980s, and it's really been a privilege that I've had to collaborate with experimentalists along the way. The initial study was done by Michael Guevara, who is now a professor at McGill, and it was done in the laboratory of Alvin Schreier, who's my colleague in the physiology department at McGill and is a longtime collaborator. So all of the experimental work is essentially was able to take place because of Alvin is able to get experiments to work. So these are balls of cardiac cells. They're about a tenth of a millimeter in diameter. In this case, they're impaled with a glass microelectrode. And through the microelectrode, you can record the potential difference between the intracellular and extracellular medium, and you're also able to deliver shocks directly to the tissue. This is an example of a resetting experiment in which there's a basic intrinsic rhythm and a stimulus is given through the microelectrode, and as a consequence of that stimulus, the basic rhythm can be reset. The beat will come at a different time than it would have come had the stimulus not been given. So this is called a phase resetting type of experiment. And it's possible to do those types of experiments in a systematic way, scanning the effect of a stimulus at different phases of the cycle and different currents being passed through the microelectrode. I'm not going to go into all of those studies. And then there's another type of experiment that can be given in which the stimulus is given periodically. This is an example of periodic stimulation of this preparation at a rate which is different than the intrinsic frequency. This, in fact, is at a rate slightly slower than the intrinsic frequency. And what happens, the stimulation rate given by these spikes is fixed, and in response to that fixed rate, the cardiac cells, the cardiac oscillator does its own thing. In this particular preparation, we believe that this is an example of chaotic dynamics, aperiodic dynamics, associated with a deterministic system. And people probably read in the newspaper this morning or yesterday, the Globe and Mail or the Gazette or whatever you might read, that one of the actual people who made fundamental discoveries, Ed Lawrence, actually died in the last few days. So we should dedicate this talk to him, I guess. One of the ways you can say, okay, here's this data. It's chaotic. What's a way that I would have to demonstrate that? And in this particular preparation, I'm mapping the phase of one stimulus as a function of the phase of the preceding stimulus, and all of these points fall on a one-dimensional curve which is consistent with the types of functions that can generate chaotic dynamics. So there's lots of analysis that goes behind this slide, but this is just an example of a type of experiment that can be done. Now, the good news, there's a good match between the theory and experiment in these particular experiments, but it may be irrelevant to real cardiac arrhythmias. Many serious arrhythmias are believed to be due to what's called reentrant mechanisms. So what does reentrant mechanism mean? It means that the oscillation that's taking place is set by excitation going around the heart in some circuitous fashion coming back to itself. Okay, so there's some kind of anatomical road in the heart so that the period of the heart is not set by the sinus nodal pacemaker, but by the length of time it takes for this excitation to go around some circuit. Now, this is a paper now that comes from the laboratory of Mark Josephson. Mark Josephson is a cardiac electrophysiologist, and I spent a year in his laboratory when he was at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, so I followed them around for a year to try to understand what they do. So this is a picture of a medical cardiac electrophysiologist, and what he's doing is he's sticking a catheter in a patient's heart, drilling a hole in their femoral vein over here. They stick the catheter in, they thread it into the heart, and then they can give stimulation in different sorts of patterns. That's one of the things they can do, and they can also give radio frequency radiation, which will heat up the tissue and will burn tissue inside the patient's heart. Okay, so that's what they can do. And he wrote this paper, which was very intriguing to me, Resetting and Entrainment of Ventricular Tachycardia Associated with Infarction. So ventricular tachycardia is, once again, these rapid heartbeats associated with the ventricles. And he's studying resetting and entrainment, just like we were studying resetting and entrainment in the chick heart cells. So he has a physical model of what's leading to ventricular tachycardia, which is an excitation going around the pathway, going around the circuitous pathway, and he is doing resetting experiments on this excitation. So does anybody know why he's doing resetting experiments? Can anybody guess what the reason to do that would be?
Also, if you can reset the rhythm.
No.
No?
Nope. He doesn't care about resetting. This is what he's doing. The way he's going to take home his paycheck is by curing the patient. He cures the patient by giving radio frequency irradiation directly to that patient's heart. This is his model of what's happening inside the patient's heart.
Burn a hole in the heart so you can't get the rhythm going.
Exactly. So he's thinking like a topologist, although Josephson wouldn't admit that. He would say, I don't know what that word means. But he's trying to do surgery on this one-dimensional manifold for the mathematicians. He's trying to change that, cut it open so that excitation can't go around that. So he does resetting, and he does a variety of other procedures to try to locate the place inside the heart to give the burn. Okay? Okay, so here's an experiment. So, yeah? Okay, so he would say, you can ask different people, so he would say that in the patients they consider to be good candidates, they can get about 70 or 80% and cure them, okay, of the ones they consider to be good candidates. That is not done as much now as it was done before, because it's a hard procedure, and you have the implantable cardiac defibrillators now, so people would generally prefer to put one of those in rather than do this procedure, unless the person has the tachycardia that comes back very frequently. You can't have, if this is coming every day, then you might want to do something, you know, consider that kind of procedure. Yeah?
In the successful instances,
yeah,
I have a problem by seeing that if part of the heart now is gone,
yeah,
burnt out, then wouldn't you have some other problems to deal with later on? I mean, yeah, for a while, for in the short term,
yeah,
the pain is there, obviously.
Yeah. Okay, no. So first of all, I'm not as familiar with the long-term statistics. The thing is that you can say, what part of the heart are they burning? So what they're trying to identify here, first of all, there are other arrhythmias in which this is very successful over many years. For ventricular tachycardia, I believe it's successful. Generally, they think that it's due in these patients, in some of the patients that are candidates that he's talking about in that paper, to patients who have a strand or multiple strands of viable tissue going through a scar that's left by the heart attack. And so that strand is not doing anything except providing an anatomical circuit to complete this electronic circuit. So if you can knock out a piece of that strand, then you haven't really damaged anything in the function of the heart, but you've eliminated this anatomical substrate for that arrhythmia. That's the theory, and I believe that they think it's reasonably successful. Mind you, generally this is already in a patient that has problems, right? Because they've had those problems. So this is an experiment, this is a physiological experiment, back again on these aggregates of Chikard cells. Here there's a spontaneous rhythm. Here's 4 stimuli are given. Here's 15 stimuli are given. This is the last. Here's 50 stimuli are given. And here's the rhythm after those stimuli are completed. So what do you notice here? You notice that following this rapid stimulation, the intrinsic pacemaker has slowed down. Okay? So this is a phenomenon that people call overdrive suppression, and this is what this phenomenon refers to, this particular type of experiment. So we can do an experiment now in which there's a microelectrode in these aggregates of cells. You detect the action potential, you detect the depolarization, the activity of that. You wait a certain delay, length of time, and after that length of time, you give a stimulus after this fixed delay back to this beating aggregate of cells, and then you can study what happens as a function of what that. So you're essentially making this reentrance circuit, but part of the loop of the circuit is not the heart, it's an electronic loop which has been added to this cardiac preparation. Kind of hybrid system, which a biological system is up to an electronic circuit. So when that's done, what happens is you can observe, if you look over here, this is when the delay is 410 milliseconds in the return. Here there's an initial spontaneous beat from the pacemaker. There's then a sequence of stimuli which lead to an action potential, which lead to another beat. The last stimulus over here doesn't lead to another beat. it's not able to excite it. And after a little while, there's another stimulus, and then you're off to the races again. So essentially what happens is there's a burst of activity, which really is starting spontaneously and is terminating spontaneously, and then there's another one. If you make the delay shorter, then you have shorter sequences of bursts, and you also have these bursting rhythms in which the duration of the burst is depending on the number of pulses. Well, based on the physiological properties of the rapid stimulation leading, notice here, the rhythm here is more rapid than the control rhythm that was initially present. The rapid stimulation is changing the physiological properties according to this idea of overdrive suppression, leading to making it more difficult to stimulate. So the same stimulus that led to activity here is now going to be blocked. Yeah?
This sounds really like some LTC-type phenomenon. Was there an attempt to look at what happened to that junction in the interface?
We haven't done that. Okay. At the end, if you want, I'll tell you what I think the mechanism is of what's happening here, but we don't know what the actual mechanism is. So, the heart, the real heart, is a spatially distributed system. It's not just a little pacemaker ball. So we became interested about 10 years ago or 12 years ago in trying to look at in vitro models of cardiac arrhythmias in which cells are plated, cells are cultured in different geometries, and then they can be imaged using either voltage or calcium sensitive dyes. So I'll show you a series of experiments. The main person who did these experiments now is Gil Bubb, and once again working in Alvin Schreier's laboratory. So there's a macroscope, so there's illumination, and then these dyes are fluorescent dyes, and the fluorescence is differentially sensitive to either calcium or voltage sensitive differences. And in that fashion, you're able to track dynamics in a little in about a 1 centimeter square area. So these experiments are done using basically the same cells that were done to build the aggregates, and these are cells which are dispersed from the ventricles of chicken hearts, and are then can be plated at different densities. So they can be plated at different densities and different geometries, and also with different drugs added to the tissue culture. And I'll just show you some of the experiments. So one of the experiments, this is, let's see if I can get this to go. So one of the types of behavior that you can have, this is now calcium sensitive dye. You can have a pacemaker, which sends out waves which go around the ring, collide at the opposite side. So here we have a pacemaker driving what's happening. And then when we have it plated in a ring, we can also have a situation in which there's a wave that's traveling around the ring, just very similar to the type of picture that Josephson had. And then we can also have a much more complicated behavior, much more complicated behaviors. In this behavior, we believe there's a pacemaker up at about 12 o'clock. You can see, we'll start at the beginning. This loops. So let's just wait. Here's the pacemaker. Okay. Pacemaker, going. Now here, this is going to go. It gets blocked in one way. It keeps on going around the ring. Then it's interfering, the pacemaker comes back, and there can be complicated going back and forth between the pacemaker and a wave going around the ring. So we're interested in trying to come up with a mathematical model which would have similar behavior to that. And so this is the only, so if there are people here who are biologists, please excuse me, but this is a math institute. So this is just a modification of one of the classic models for excitable media, the Fitzhugh-Nagumo equation, and there have been additional terms added to try to represent heterogeneities, which would be pacemakers, and those pacemakers could be sensitive to the frequency at which they're being stimulated. So the basic property, the basic thing here is that there's a pacemaker here, which is initially going to drive the excitation, and then there's another pacemaker over there, and the waves that are generated from here are eventually going to get blocked over there, and then the waves are going to circulate around the ring. So this is meant to have cyclic boundary conditions. Waves will travel around the ring, and that's what you're going to see if it works. So let's just see. Okay, there's the pacemaker. See the waves going out? They collide on the other side, but now look. Up, colliding. Wave gets blocked, and it keeps on going around the ring. Okay? And so, and then this wave would continue, and then eventually it would get blocked over there. The pacemaker would take place again also. Yes? Yeah. So, yeah, no, okay, so the pacemakers are only at local places in the medium, okay?
Okay.
So there are only the currents associated with the pacemaker at a couple of localized places, okay? So wait, there are two different things. One is a model, and another is experiment.
So in the experiment, I'm asking about the experiment.
No, the experiment, I can just conjecture what might happen. And some of those traces can actually be from, sometimes there can be the same trace at different times also. So you can have, depending on many details, it's not just the positioning, it can be heterogeneous. It can be details of heterogeneity. It can be small things in the preparation that we don't control. It can be slight fluctuations in internal or external potassium ions. You can get some different locations of pacemakers, spontaneous pacemakers. You can get different conduction velocities. You can get different refractory periods. There are many different possible.
So those are observed behaviors that you can see in just one preparation, isn't it?
Yeah. Sometimes the preparations can be quite dynamic and change. Mind you, there are limitations on the length of time you can observe the preparations because the dyes tend to bleed. So generally an hour is about the most we can observe them. Yeah?
Is the constant of your test related to some particular from
where
you derive, like
0.039. Yeah, crazy. Just make up numbers. It's not based on measurements of the electrophysiology of cardiac cells.
Yeah.
You're trying to add a term which leads to an oscillation in the Fitzhugh-Nagomo equation, which normally doesn't have an oscillation. So you know something about the magnitude of the term that has to be added. Right? I agree. It's not pretty. But it is kind of pretty that you can start off with a ring with two localized pacemakers, and you can start it off and you get symmetry breaking, you get a chirality symmetry breaking because of the difference in the locations of these pacemakers. Yeah?
It has nothing to do with media.
What?
It has nothing to do with some media.
This is kind of a generic model of the media. So this is just one of the versions of the Fitzhugh-Nagumo equations for. Yeah.
So what's causing the blocking? Is it sort of the interaction?
Okay. So in this particular model, what we try to do is model the buildup of refractoriness as a result of stimulating it more rapidly than what it would want to be. So this model is actually based on the types of experimental results that I showed in the previous slide, where the rapid stimulation leads to more refractoriness. Okay, so you can also plot these in two dimensions. So these are pictures now of what happens in two dimensions. You can get pacemakers, you can get spiral waves, and you can do imaging using calcium-sensitive dyes or voltage-sensitive dyes. So as many of the people here know, spiral waves have been hypothesized as a mechanism for ventricular tachycardia and ventricular fibrillation by many people going back to Norbert Wiener, Valentine Krinsky, Odd Winfrey, Maurizio Lese, Pepe Halife, and many other people. So this is well known. So this is from an experiment that Gil Bubb did and published in Physical Review Letters in 2005. So Gil varied two variables. One is the density of the cells, and the other is a compound that blocks the communication between the cells, that reduces the communication between the cells. And I'm going to try to start these 9 motion pictures simultaneously. So in the healthiest one of these, which is the upper left-hand corner, there tends to be a pacemaker, which is sending off these spontaneous beats. And then the least healthy, the very low density and the high drug concentration, there are very poorly formed waves which propagate and die out. And in between that, you can observe a phenomena which is a spontaneous initiation of rotating spiral waves, which also spontaneously terminate. So in the theoretical, this is experimental data, and the theoretical interpretation we have of this is based on just incorporating basic physiological properties that we talked about before. These are that the cells can propagate excitation, it can go from one cell to the next, that there's some heterogeneity, that there's not everything uniform, completely uniform in all directions. Some of the cells can have spontaneous rhythm where they will generate an activity every once in a while. And then also there's this phenomenon of overdrive suppression or fatigue, where if cells are rapidly excited, then after rapid excitation they get to be more difficult to excite than they had before. So if you put together these behaviors in very simple cellular automata type model, if you have very strong connectivity, like you would have if everything is very healthy, when a region leads to an excitation, that excitation will travel throughout the whole tissue, will go off, and will lead, and nothing will happen. But in situations where there's poorer connectivity, you can have those waves breaking up spontaneously. Those waves will lead to spiral waves, which will re-enter on themselves. They will continue to evolve in time, and then this is all slides from the same time series. Then after quite a long time, you'll have a situation in which this excitation wave actually dies out at the end, and there's no more activity. So this is a mechanism that could give rise to the sorts of non-sustained rapid rhythms such as we observed before. I know that there are several people here who are interested in neural systems, and in neural systems there are many, many examples of bursting activity, and one of the things I'll just suggest is the possibility that the bursting activity in neural systems could in some cases be sustained by a similar mechanism to this, but you would have to try to do measurements of the spatiotemporal pattern of activity just in addition to what's happening locally from one or two places. Okay, so then there we propose universal organization. So we know everybody has known about targets and spirals or having block, but what we also observed is that there can be certain regions in which there can be bursts of activity, and the bursts of activity are associated with these rotating spirals And even though there's no individual cell which is giving a burst, the burst is a collective property or an emergent property of the medium. Okay, so this is as far as I want to talk about these model experiments, and in the last 10 minutes or so, I wanted to go back and say something about people. Okay, so this is a rhythm. This is now an electrocardiogram of a patient, of actually a 15-year-old boy who was on the lunch line in Illinois, and he fainted. He was referred to a pediatric cardiologist, and the pediatric cardiologist was a former nuclear physicist who knew I was interested in these types of rhythms, so he sent me these rhythms. So this is now a normal beat. This is actually, for people who might be used to looking at these electrocardiograms, I'm not sure, this is a patient who had actually had a hole in his heart surgically repaired when he was quite young, so the electrocardiogram's not completely normal. So here you can see the P waves, however. Here's the QRS complex, the T waves. Here are these abnormal premature ventricular complexes that are taking place. And underneath here is the interpretation of this rhythm. So here's the normal sinus rhythm. Here is a ectopic pacemaker. Pacemaker in an abnormal location in the ventricles, which is generating its own periodic rhythm, which is taking place at a frequency which is different from the rhythm frequency of the normal sinus rhythm. So the interpretation is that if this beat occurs outside of the refractory period of the ventricles, then you see that abnormal complex. If it occurs during the refractory period of the ventricles, then that's blocked and you don't see it, but these things keep on coming along. Each of these two rhythms with different frequencies just marching along and interacting in this rather primitive type of fashion. So one of the things we can do to look at these rhythms is we can count the number of normal beats that take place between abnormal beats. In this case, we see 1, 2, 3, 4 normal beats between two abnormal beats. Here we see 2 normal beats between 2 abnormal beats, and there we see 1. Some people might notice that the shape of this is a little bit different than the shape of those others, and the interpretation here is that that's because both of these pacemakers fire at about the same time. The beats collide, and they're called a fusion beat by electrocardiologists. So can you remember these three numbers, 4, 2, and 1? Okay? So because of this very simple mathematical structure, we're able to do a complete analysis of the mathematics of this particular problem, and it turns out that it's equivalent to a problem in number theory called the gaps and steps problem, which even if people are mathematicians or number theorists here, probably most people haven't heard of that particular problem. Okay? But you can come up with rules. So we can now take a long record, we can count the number of abnormal beats between normal beats, and if we assume that these two rhythms are constant and the refractory time of the heart is constant, we can come up with the following rules, that in that sequence there are 3 integers, 1, 2, and 4 are 3 integers, 1 of the integers is odd, 1 is an odd number, 2 and 4 are even numbers, the sum of the 2 smaller integers is 1 less than the largest, 1 plus 2 is equal to 3, which is 1 less than 4. And moreover, we can look and we can see for any, these are now axes in which we have the 3 parameters displayed with the, so this is the ratio of the cycle length of the abnormal beat divided by the cycle length of the normal beat, and here's the ratio of the refractory time normalized by the cycle length of the sinus beat. So for any combination of those, we can see exactly what numbers we would expect to see in the sequence. For example, in that particular trace occurred approximately over here. So when we discovered this, we were very excited about this because here's a real electrocardiogram, real rhythm, real person, and you can come up with this number theoretic analysis of what's actually happening in these real people. So we were excited. Actually, does anybody here know David Newman? David Newman? Yeah, a cardiologist. What?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, he's a good guy. He's a great guy. So
he used to work for
him. He what?
He used to work for him to help him.
Oh yeah. Okay, so he's a cardiologist in Toronto. He heard me talk about this at some meeting, and he was a fellow in San Francisco. This is a story that I couldn't tell for about 15 years, but I can tell it now. He worked for this cardiologist in San Francisco, and when he heard me talk about this, David was very excited, and he invited me to come to San Francisco. The guy from the chief of the service in San Francisco is a very well-known cardiologist. He had also come from Brooklyn, so we were buddy-buddy and all things like that. And they took me out to a great restaurant the night before I gave the talk, and, you know, really terrific, terrific food. And then I gave this. I showed this result, and at the end of the talk, or maybe in the middle of the talk, he said, "This is nothing more than intellectual masturbation." Okay? So I didn't have I'm not sure if I had a good response then. I think I might have said, "Well, we all have to get it off in our own way," but I'm not sure if I really said that. Okay, so this is just a follow-up. The other theorized, we've also extended that by trying to add stochastic, some stochastic terms, comparing it in detail with what happens in individual patients. This is a paper done in collaboration with Eric Goldberger at Beth Israel Deaconess, also Gene Stanley, who's a theoretical physicist at Boston University. Many people here might be familiar with it, and a postdoc, Verena Schultz-Rowland, who was working with Gene Stanley at the time. So using this model but adding stochastic terms, we're able to get very good agreement with what's happening in individual patients. And one of the things that we were able to do... Yes? No. This is added to circle maps. Yeah. One of the things that we worked on doing is trying to represent the dynamics that are present in real patients over 24-hour Holter tapes in some compact way, so we can try to get pictures of what the dynamics are. So these are complicated plots. On this axis, we have the interbeat interval of the normal sinus rhythm, the time between the normal heart. And let's just look at this one. This counts the number of normal beats between two premature ventricular complexes. And what this is the coupling interval, the time from the normal sinus beat to the premature ventricular complex. And these are really two-dimensional histograms, and here we see how these can vary as a function of what the sinus speed is. So if we went through this in detail, we would see that there's really amazing correspondence here. We can see this is data from a patient, and we can see that there's amazing correspondence between what you have here and what you actually have in the mathematical model. Okay, so good news, bad news. So I think we really do understand this rhythm, arrhythmia, extremely well, but that's good for us. It's generally considered a benign arrhythmia, so that's good if you have it, because it's not considered to kill people. Only a small percentage, maybe probably less than 10% of records with frequent premature ventricular complexes appear to agree with the theoretical predictions we can make of these. And cardiologists do not care about this arrhythmia at all, as was evidenced by this cardiologist's remark. In some sense, I think that there must be some interesting psychological factor that here are these observations, which he doesn't know these number rules, but actually it's completely irrelevant to what he has to do in order to cure people. So I'm just going to finish up with a few last slides. So this is once again from a record which comes from the PhysioNet website of patients who died while they were wearing a Holter tape. So this is one of these heart prints, different color scheme. But the thing over here is, unlike that previous record, over a range of sinus rates, the number of intervening beats was not spread out over all intervals. It tended to just be one intervening beat between abnormal beats, or it came in bursts in which there was this alternation, normal, abnormal, that I showed before. And also the coupling interval tended to be quite fixed. I will show this trace. There's a colony of dogs in Cornell, of German Shepherd dogs, that are very susceptible to spontaneous ventricular tachycardia. This is from Sidney Moise and Robert Gilmore. They have non-sustained ventricular tachycardia, which is very prevalent, and they also have increased incidence of sudden cardiac death. And when we look at heart prints in some of these dogs, we see something which seems to be extremely similar to that one other patient that we saw before, but which is very different from that patient that we had with parasystole. So almost certainly a different mechanism is happening in this dog and that patient from what was happening in parasystole. In terms of, so this is only for people who would really be into the electrocardiology. We can talk about it afterwards. This is consistent with the records were consistent with the mechanism associated with what's called long QT syndrome, and those patients are susceptible to an arrhythmia called torsade de Pointe. So this is from a paper that was just published last year in Journal of Electrocardiology, and we're now, the dog data has never been published, the dog analysis has never been published, and we're now trying to look at analysis of some data sets of patients who have died, or not died, who have had data downloaded from implantable cardiac defibrillators to try to see what's happening. In some patients, there are storage of some comparatively small number of beats before they had a cardiac arrest, but to try to see what's happening before and to see what patterns are at all similar to what we see over here. Okay. So to finish, there's a challenge for cardiology, which is to develop a deeper understanding of events that precede fatal arrhythmias with a view of better predicting those at risk for sudden cardiac death. Since the bifurcations to fatal arrhythmias may be different in different people, this requires analysis of electrographic records of many individual patients. So I would say this is a highly maligned activity. It is hard to fund and it is hard to publish. So there's enormous amounts of data in the electrocardiograms which can be analyzed or thought about from a nonlinear dynamics perspective, and it's almost like you want to understand what's happening in each individual patient, which is a very different concept of thinking about things from your clinical study with 1,500 patients and so forth. So I've tried to refer to many of the people who've made the biggest contributions during the course of the talk, and also I thank funding agencies, NSERC, CIHR, MITAX, NIH, Ari Goldberg is resource in the United States and the Canadian Heart and Stroke Foundation. So thanks for listening, and I'm happy to discuss further.